compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Cyrus, you asked me if I listened to the show yesterday. I had a day off. Did you tell everybody why I had the day off, or was that kept secret?
Just R&R.
Just R&R.
But those who listened on Monday know.
They do indeed. Well, hopefully it'll be better today. No, my voice was just shredded. And if you heard Monday's show, you probably heard. You heard it. And so Tuesday, it just wasn't happening. So I'm so thankful to Father Matthew Spencer for filling in for me. He always does such a great job. And, you know, you asked me if I listened at all. I did dip in just a little bit, and I thought, he's doing such a great job, I don't need to worry about it. Not that I was.
Yeah, he's great. They should give him his own show.
He had his own show.
I know.
That's the joke. That's I get joke. It. Yeah. 888-914-9149. I'm still kind of croaking along here, so please bear with me, but it's much better than it was yesterday. It's amazing what a little bit of lemon and honey will do for the throat. But I did try to rest it as much as possible.
Does Nancy take care of you when you're sick?
Oh, of course.
That's good. I'm a baby. I'm a big baby when I'm sick.
You're feeling sorry for yourself?
Oh, when I'm sick, I sure do. I'm like, I can't do anything.
You know, she takes such good care of me that the last time I was sick, and that's very infrequently, very, very infrequently. But the last time I just felt really blah and like I didn't want to get out of bed, she brought me a bowl of chicken noodle soup. So yeah,
yep.
That's the depth of her affection. Well, I mean, it goes much deeper than that, obviously, but that's part of it. So yeah, so I missed the show yesterday. It was in great hands. Father Matthew Spencer always does such a great job. You know, he would have his own show still to this very day if it weren't for the fact that he's so busy. He's the superior of his community. And so that, actually, I believe he's a provincial now. And so that means that he's got just duty after duty stacked on him that didn't really allow him to do the show anymore because it's a daily commitment, obviously. But it's always great to have him back. So did I miss anything exciting? Were there any fireworks? I can't imagine Father Matthew igniting fireworks.
No.
He's such a gentle
no
soul.
No fireworks. We talked about going to confession and Number and Kind. And
that's good.
And
oh, he talked about Number and Kind too.
He did, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it was very interesting. He talked about, one time he was in a confessional and his phone, he said something and it woke his phone up.
Oh my
gosh. So it was a good lesson to not take your phone into the confessional with you. And so I thought of you immediately.
Well, you've heard me preach that before about the idea of I never bring my phone into the confessional. Because when I go to confession, I'm assuming that the phone is off, but you know, these crazy phones and these crazy companies
always listening.
Always listening. And that's the part that it can be very unnerving. I've talked about this before, but just real quickly, you remember when we had a lady call in, this is a couple years ago, and you're producing, and a lady called in and she asked a question about, is it moral in the eyes of the church to have excess skin removal surgery if you've been very heavy, you lose a lot of weight, and so the weight's gone, but you have the saggy, baggy skin. Is it okay? My phone just woke up. Look at that.
speak of the devil.
It literally just woke up. How does that happen? So where was I? Okay, so you lose all the weight, but you still have all the saggy, baggy skin. Is it, you know, would it be like vanity or pride if you had the surgery to remove it? So excess skin removal surgery. How often do you talk about that? How often do you even hear about that? Never, probably.
Never. That was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, it was a rhetorical question, but I thought maybe you might jump in. So even though you've heard the story before, Cyrus, it's worth mentioning in the context of what Father Matthew apparently spoke about yesterday about not bringing your phone into the confessional. And that is simply this, that it was on that same show that I had covered a story about how your iPhone or your Android is always listening. Now, they make claims, the companies claim, no, it's not, it's only like listening for certain commands, or it's only listening for certain things, or there are only certain apps that are allowed to do certain things by way of the microphone, and all of that being the case. So I did a whole story on that. At some point, the lady calls in, asks the question about excess skin removal surgery. Within 15 minutes, you may remember this, Iris, I got a call from another lady, different part of the country. She said, I've been listening to the show. You know, I've got goosebumps because about 15 minutes ago, you talked about excess skin removal surgery, a topic she had never thought of before. And within 15 minutes, the browser on her cell phone was serving her ads for excess skin removal surgery. And it all happened in real time on this program. Who am I to argue with that, right?
Yeah, we can't fight technology. It's always listening. Our TVs
Soylent
are
Green
listening.
Is people, by the way, Cyrus. FYI. So yeah, I'm a big believer, and that show really solidified for me my grudging acceptance that, like it or not, whether they admit to it or not, they can jump up and down and deny it. But I do believe that these devices really do listen. And I guess just word to the wise, right? So if you go to confession, my advice, leave it in the car. Turn it off and leave it in the car. But that was interesting. So when Father was hearing confessions and his iPhone woke up, did it startle the penitent?
I think it did. I don't remember the specifics, but it happened to be someone he knew, and they talked about it later, or maybe even in the confessional. He's like, oh, don't worry about it. So Father's, you know, apologize. Oh, I'm so sorry, and don't worry about it.
Oh, man.
Luckily, it was somebody he knew.
Wow. Well, I mean, these things happen. So, hey, by the way, not yesterday, because I wasn't on the program, but day before yesterday, I fielded a call, and I even apologized to the caller because, in retrospect, I thought maybe I had come out of the gate a bit too brutally, and so I apologized to the guy because he wasn't calling in to be querulous. He had a question about the different translations of the Bible into English. Remember this call, Cyrus? I think it was Monday morning.
I do. You apologized to him right away.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's not even the main thing, but I wanted to make sure people remembered that call. And that's what I remember about the call, was that I think I said something, and what I said was true, but I said, like, everything you just said is false. And I think the poor guy probably felt like I was, you know, attacking, and I didn't mean to come across that way. But the gist of that topic was, there was a question about whether or not there were Bibles available in English before the time of the Protestant Reformation. And so I was alluding to information that I had written about in one of my books, but I didn't have it in front of me. So I only gave a kind of cursory thumbnail description of it. Well, since I had some time off yesterday, I did my homework, and I have that section of a book that I wrote. It's called Envoy for Christ, 25 Years as a Catholic Apologist. Now, I wrote that, I don't know, 15 years ago or whenever it was, 10 years ago. And I'd like to quote to you the section from that book that I was alluding to. Now, please keep in mind that in the book, it's footnoted to the various sources that I paraphrased from. So there were some different articles, one article by Father Paul Stenhouse. He wrote a kind of a magazine-style booklet called Catholic Answers to Bible Christians, and he had a lengthy section in there that I quote from. And this was an article that I had written at the time when I worked at Catholic Answers. So this is going back to 1988. And the article was entitled, Don't Touch That Bible. I don't think that article is still available at the Catholic Answers website, because the newsletter, from what I understand, is not available on the website. But it's in my book. So I thought I'd read to you the pertinent section to kind of flesh out what I was alluding to. So I quote one of the prominent anti-Catholic writers from the Protestant world back in the 20th century. His name was Lorraine Bettner. He was a Calvinist. And he wrote a rather large book called Roman Catholicism that is filled with errors of fact and just fabrications, half-truths, etc. Others have done work in terms of debunking it. But here's a little section that I took up long ago. So from his book, he wrote, up until the time of the Reformation, the Bible has been or had been a book for priests only. It was written in Latin, and the Roman Church refused to allow it to be translated into the language of the common people. But when the Reformers came on the scene, all of that changed. Luther translated the entire Bible into German for the people of his native land. And within 25 years of its appearance, 100 editions of the German Bible came off the press. It was also soon translated into most of the vernacular tongues of Europe. And whenever the light of the Reformation went, it became the book of the common people. Decrees of popes and church councils gave way to the word of life. All right. Not much truth at all there. So here was my response to that. And I was drawing from a variety of different sources. So I paraphrase a good deal of it. And then I quote specifically from one source. So here's what I had to say. Let's examine the facts. Before Luther's translation of the Bible into German, that was in 1530, there were already at least 33 printed German translations, many of them translated from the original Greek and Hebrew, according to Fust's at Metz in 1462. So this is referring to an historian who compiled some of these details. And these details were cited in a book that came out long ago. And so I was citing and paraphrasing from this book that had cited these details. So that there's one in Metz in Germany, 1462. So keep in mind, Luther issued his translation in 1530. One from Bemler in Augsburg in 1467. Others in Augsburg and Nuremberg in 1477. At Leipzig in Germany, 1466. And that was reprinted at least 16 times by 1522. So that was a German Bible that had been translated by Catholics. It had gone into reprint at least 16 times by the time Martin Luther got his start as the sort of titular head of the new Protestant movement. Another at Wittenberg in 1470 and 1483 and 1490. Another one at Augsburg in 1518. At Lübeck in 1494 and Kutna in 1498. Another German Bible that had been produced in Venice in 1506, and then another one in Venice in 1511. In the 15th century in Poland, so we're now well before the time, a century before the time of Martin Luther, the Bible was translated into the vernacular, meaning Polish, at the behest of the Catholic Queen Hedwig. A second version was translated soon after by Andrew Jasowitz in Spain, King Alfonso the Wise. He lived from 1221 to 1284. He commissioned the Bible to be translated into Castilian. So this is 500 years, nearly, before the time of Martin Luther. 300 years, excuse me. I can still do math in my head. So 300 years before the time of Martin Luther, the King of Spain has the Bible translated into the language of the people. Saint Vincent Ferrer translated it into the Valencian dialect in 1405. In France, there are records of at least 16 translations of the Bible into French that were available before 1547. Archbishop Giacomo of Genoa translated the Bible into Italian around 1220. A Swedish translation was made as early as the mid-14th century, and Iceland had its own translation of the Holy Bible in its own language in the year 1279. A Catholic monk, Niccolo Malimeri's Italian translation had been reprinted at least 13 times before the light of the Reformation had ignited Europe into a conflagration of dissension. In addition to European languages, the Bible was being translated under the direction of the Catholic Church into Arabic, Syriac, Ethiopian, Armenian, Chinese, and Hindi, even before the Reformation got started. Now, keep in mind that in some of these cases, the manuscripts of the Bible were already in those languages. It was already in Syriac, for example. It was already in some of these ancient Middle Eastern languages. But the Catholic Church made sure to translate them into languages like Chinese and Hindi. And again, long before the time of Martin Luther. So continuing with my commentary, a common assertion is that there were no Bibles in English until John Wycliffe. who was touted by Protestants as the morning star of the Reformation. And that was in 1382. Wycliffe, who was a Catholic priest and a leading Oxford philosopher and theologian, he got in trouble because of his radical ideas on social issues. Later, he went into open rebellion against the Catholic Church when he attacked the sacrament of penance and the validity of tradition. He denied the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, and he taught a version of the heretical notion of sola scriptura, and he also became a severe critic of the papacy, which he called the institution of the Antichrist. Keep in mind, he was doing all that in the 1380s. When Wycliffe and his followers, who are known as the Lollards, and that's a pejorative term meaning mumblers, he issued his own English translation of the Bible, the church condemned it, not because it had been translated into the vernacular, that had already been done with the encouragement of the Catholic Church, but it was condemned because of its source, which in itself was quite enough of a reason to condemn it. It also included, in some of the notes, various doctrinal errors. So what I'm going to do is, when we return, there's a little bit more I want to share with you. And this actually comes from St. Thomas More, who was the Lord Chancellor of England. He was a martyr under King Henry VIII. And he, and I alluded to this in my comments on Monday, he gave kind of an expose about the reality of Bibles being available in English long before the time of the Protestant Reformation. And I'm going to share with you, when we return from this break, what St. Thomas More said in his defense of the Catholic Church being under attack in his day on this issue. So stand by for that. I also have got, later in the show today, some information about the history of tarot cards and why they're so dangerous and why you need to stay away from them. You don't want to miss that either. I'll have that and your phone calls right after this.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Great song. I bet a lot of people listening don't know who's doing this song. Crank it up there, Cyrus. You. You. You know. All right, that's the Beatles. Not one of their commercially successful songs.
What album is this from? Because
I believe it appears on Rarities, which was issued in the late 70s.
Was it like a B-sides type thing?
Yeah, you know, I'd have to go back and look at Paul McCartney's the lyrics books that I received for my birthday. It's in there. I have to look it up, though.
Oh, it gets weird.
Fun. Oh, yeah.
I don't know this one at all.
Oh, it gets weirder. Keep it in the background. Keep it lower. And then when it gets weirder, we'll pick it up again.
Oh, all right.
I think this was one of those deals where they were fooling around in the studio, and they just were rolling the tape, and this is what they came up with.
Yeah.
It gets weirder. You know what? You think it's weird? It's going to get weirder. Did it cut off?
I made this for you like a year ago.
Oh, okay.
And I cut it off there.
Well, what happens is Paul McCartney goes into a sort of like a lounge act, you know my name, and he does the whole like fake lounge singer thing. And it's funny. So if you get a chance, but I believe the first I ever heard of it was when the repackaged album Rarities came out, which featured different versions of Beatles songs that everybody was familiar with. So that's it. That's when I first heard it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So let's get back to what I was talking about. And that is what St. Thomas More had to say in response to the claim that John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation, who was a Catholic priest, he got into a lot of trouble with the Catholic Church a couple of centuries before Martin Luther. And he was espousing some of the well, not exactly the same, but very similar ideas with regard to scripture and tradition that Martin Luther eventually got himself into. But it's a common misunderstanding. People think that it was John Wycliffe who kind of opened up the Bible in English for the common folk who didn't have access to the Bible. So St. Thomas More, in his response, he sets the record straight. Here's what he said. He refers to the 1408 Council of Oxford and how it explained why illicit translations of the Bible had been condemned by the church. And he says this in the context of saying that there were many virtuous and learned men who had translated into the English tongue and by good and godly people with devotion and soberness, well and reverently read and took upon themselves to read the Holy Bible. But he points out that Wycliffe had a more malicious purpose to translate it. So referring back to the Council of Oxford in 1408, it says, it is dangerous, as St. Jerome declares, to translate the text of the Holy Scripture out of one idiom or language into another, since it is not easy in translating to preserve exactly the same meaning in all things. We therefore command, this is the council speaking, we therefore command and ordain that henceforth no one translate any passages of Holy Scripture into English or any other language in a book or booklet or a tract of this kind lately made in the time of the said John Wycliffe or since, or that hereafter, it sounds like a legal contract, doesn't it? Or that hereafter may be made either in part or wholly, either publicly or privately, under pain of excommunication, until such translation shall have been approved and allowed by the diocesan bishop of the place, if need be, or by the provincial council, referring to a religious order. So basically, a couple things to note here. This was already happening. This was already something that the people in England were seeing, and that was the Bible was being translated into English. So when John Wycliffe came along with his noise machine of accusations and arguments against the Catholic Church, well, he kind of created a spectacle and a problem. So as a way to deal with it, that council said, all right, henceforth, paraphrasing here, henceforth, nobody translates the Bible into English unless it's approved by your bishop. So if you translate the Bible into English and you do a good job, you're an abbot or a scholar or what have you, and you undertake to do this, of course, the implicit information here is that if you did this and your diocesan bishop approves it, no problem. But if you are filling your Bible translation with either tendentious translations or footnotes that could be injurious to people's understanding of the faith, well, if you don't get permission from your bishop to do that, then you can't do it. So that's essentially the point there. St. Thomas More, for his part, he evoked the spirit of the Council of Oxford in his condemnation of Wycliffe's translation and in his rebuttal to the Protestant claim that the church had a history of officially forbidding vernacular translations. St. Thomas More said the Catholic Church neither forbiddeth the translations to be read that were always done of old before Wycliffe's days, nor damneth his, referring to Wycliffe's, because it was new, but because it was not new. Nor did the church prohibit new translations to be made, but provided that they shall not be made amiss, till they be by good examination amended. So referring to the approval of the local bishop. So here's where we get into a section from Father Paul Stenhouse's booklet called Catholic Answers to Bible Christians. I'm just going to quote him verbatim. There was no need to try to summarize or paraphrase it. Here's what he said. St. Thomas More says, in essence, that the church, far from forbidding translations, simply believed that standards of translation should be strict. Quality control is taken for granted in all aspects of daily life these days. The church still expects that sacred scripture should be given at least the same respect that we pay the food that we eat, the homes that we inhabit, or the cars that we drive. He's quoting here, in 1844, the Reverend S.R. Maitland, librarian to the Archbishop of Canterbury, published a book entitled The Dark Ages, in which he demolished, one should have thought forever, the myth that no Catholic in pre-Reformation England ever knew his Bible well. None of the facts collected by Maitland, a non-Catholic historian, supports Protestant claims. Thus, in 705, St. Adhelm is reported to have bought a Bible from a ship that entered Dover Harbor and he presented it to the Abbey of Malmesbury. King Offa, king of the Mercians, presented a Bible. These are Bibles in English, or English of that time, presented a Bible to the church at Worcester in 780. It's like 800 years before the time of Martin Luther. Paul, abbot of St. Albans, in 1077, presented two Bibles in English, adorned with gold and silver and precious stones, to the church there. His successor, Abbot Walter, donated a golden text of the Gospels. Maitland quotes a letter of one monk to another written about the year 1170, who said, "A monastery without a library is like a castle without an armory. See to it, therefore, that in your armory of defense, the greatest defense of all is not wanting. That defense is the Holy Bible." By the way, I'd like to share with you, before I continue, a little. I forget where I first heard this line. It wasn't original to me. Somebody said it. I heard it. But I think it's very important to know, because it's true, and that is, when people tell you that the Catholic Church chained the Bible so that people couldn't read it, they had it all chained up. In fact, if you go into certain medieval monasteries, even to this day, not to mention old Catholic churches throughout Europe, even to this day, you could see on the pulpit where there was this heavy metal, you know, I'm not sure what to call it, a link, I suppose. And there, the Bible would be chained so that it could not be removed from the pulpit. And that chain was heavy and virtually unbreakable. And the binding of the Holy Bible that was there had this metal part inside it so that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for the average person to leave with that Bible. And so the fact that this was very common throughout Europe is widely misunderstood, and many people have wrongly assumed that that meant that the Catholic Church was trying to prevent the Bible from being available for the people. But the opposite is true. And here's where that line came in. I don't remember who said it, but I think it's very apt. And that is that the Catholic Church chained the Bible for all those years for the same reason that the telephone company chains telephone books in telephone booths. Now, those of you who are under the age of, let's say, 35, and who never saw a telephone booth, they're relics of a bygone era. Those of you who remember, you go to a telephone booth and there would be a steel sort of cord-like chain that was attached to the heavy plastic black binder that surrounded the yellow pages. And it was chained in the telephone booth. And the reason it was chained there was so that people couldn't take it home. Because if it wasn't chained, people would take it. Hey, look, free phone book. So it wouldn't be there when you got into the phone booth to make a phone call if you had to look up something. So that's a very important consideration here, is that, yeah, the Catholic Church did change Bibles, but for that reason, so that they wouldn't get stolen. Keep in mind how precious they were as well. And monks spent the better part of their lives, in many cases, hand copying these parchments, these Bible versions, so that they would be available for future generations, which is one of the great ironies. When somebody comes to you, maybe they show up at your front door or you're talking to them in some other context and they start trying to use the Bible to attack the Catholic Church, the great irony is that they wouldn't even have that Bible had it not been for those anonymous monks for well over 1,000 years and beyond that. Before Martin Luther was even a twinkle in his daddy's eye, these anonymous Catholic monks were hand copying the Holy Bible to keep it, and I'm speaking more specifically here about the New Testament, to keep it in existence in a language that people who could read could read. So in the West, if you could read, you could read Latin. Now, maybe you were lucky and there may have been some other local languages or national languages that you might be able to read. But any literary person from any country in the West for 1,000 years or more before the time of the Protestant Reformation, if that person was literate, he or she could read Latin. So that's why the Bible was written in Latin. That's why Pope Damasus decreed at the Council of Rome or thereabouts in the year 383, he commanded St. Jerome, his personal biblical scholar, to translate from the Greek and the Latin into Greek, I'm sorry, from the Greek and the Hebrew into Latin, for the express purpose of having the Bible available for the vast majority of people who could read. Not to mention the people who couldn't read, but who could hear. So on Sunday at Mass, when the priest would read the readings and proclaim the gospel in Latin, the whole point of it was so that the people who were in the church could understand it, because they spoke Latin. So even if you couldn't read Latin, most people in the West could speak Latin. But I digress. Back to Maitland here. And this, again, is that scholar who was on the staff of the Archbishop of Canterbury, not a Catholic, by the way. He says that in the course of his research, he came across not a single instance in which the Bible was treated disrespectfully by Catholics, and no instance of it being kept from the people. Nor did he discover in his historical researches any hint that the Bible was regarded simply as a valuable piece of furniture, hardly used at all, or simply by the monks themselves. Many of the Bibles to which Maitland refers would have been in Latin, but the author makes frequent reference also to copies in Anglo-Saxon, which was the precursor language of what we understand today as the English language. The Catholic Church, again, I'm quoting here, the Catholic Church is frequently accused of keeping the Bible in Latin so the common man couldn't understand it for himself, but this is not true for the reasons I just mentioned. Two points were often missed by both Catholics and Protestants. The first is that until the late Renaissance, most Europeans were illiterate. The clergy and the nobility were lettered, but rarely was the common man. The second point is that for those who could read, Latin posed no obstacle. Very early on, the Bible became increasingly accessible to the average European in his native idiom. Archbishop James Usher, 1581 to 1656, the Protestant Bishop of Armagh in Ireland, and a staunch foe of the Catholic Church, he gives the date for the first English translation of the Bible as 1290, a century before Wycliffe. But Usher didn't go back nearly far enough. The Venerable Bede, St. Bede, in 672, he lived 672 to 735, he translated the entire Bible into Saxon, which was the precursor language of English. So it would be understandable to his flock in England, virtually none of whom yet knew Latin. In the year 734, he wrote to Egbert. How do you like that name, Cyrus? If you went back in time to the Middle Ages, would you like Egbert as your name?
Yes.
Egbert the producer.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. He was the Archbishop of York, and he instructed him to preach to the people from the translated Bible, especially from the epistles of St. Paul. So, hey, when you preach to the people on Sunday, so nearly 1,000 years before the Protestant Reformation, 800 years roughly, he's telling the clergy, when you read the Bible, read the vernacular language one, and when you preach, preach from that version of the Bible so that people understand you. What about Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians? What about all those books? Yeah, read them all. Read them in the language of the people. In 747, at the Council of Clovesshow in England, the bishops emphasized the importance of reading the Bible in the vernacular, something that is not easily done if there were no vernacular translations, which of course there were. The council further required that the creed, remember that? I believe in one God, the Father Almighty. The creed, the Our Father, and the administration of the sacraments should be in the vernacular in order that the people's spiritual benefit might be greater. In the year 1109, Pope Innocent III wrote, "The Bishop of Metz has told us that many laymen and women too, led by a desire mainly of understanding the Bible, have translated for themselves the Gospels, the Epistles of St. Paul, and the Psalms. Their aim is that with the help of this translation, made at their own discretion, and we could wish it had been made prudently, laymen and women could expound such matters and preach to each other." Now, the desire to understand the Bible is something to be praised. Now, this again is what Pope Innocent III wrote. The desire to understand the Bible is something to be praised, not condemned. Yet it seems that here certain lay people have justly merited criticism, for they hold meetings in secret and usurp the function of preaching. So you'll notice that the Pope is actually like, that's pretty good. I'm glad they're doing that. Unfortunately, some of them are going about it the wrong way. And why do they have to have these secret meetings? What's that all about? And of course, that raised the suspicion, like, are they preaching some false doctrine? What's going on here? But you can see that the Pope himself, he was, as the kids might say, he was cool with it as a general principle. So here's the last little bit from Father Paul Townsend. He says, in the same way that Protestant ministers would admonish, actually, no, this is me speaking now. I had to go back and look at it. So this is the final part of my article. This is now me. In the same way that Protestant ministers would admonish their parishioners not to use the Jehovah's Witnesses defective Bible version called the New World Translation, and it's defective because of its many errors and misleading footnotes, the Catholic Church also warned and warns Catholics to avoid Bible translations that have similar problems. Contrary to the claims made by Lorraine Bettner and other non-Catholic writers who want us to believe otherwise, the Catholic Church did not and does not hide, quote-unquote, the Holy Bible from the faithful, but it does take seriously its obligation to shield Christians from inaccurate translations and heretical interpretations of the Bible. Boom, there it is. And that's an excerpt from that book that I mentioned called Envoy for Christ, if you care to read it. By the way, it is on, it is, you know, now that I think about it, not only is there a Kindle edition, there's also an Audible edition. And the reason I remember that is because I read the book. It took me like 3 weeks. No, I read the book in its entirety, so it's available as an audiobook too, for that matter. But what the heck? This would be a good time to take a break. I wanted to make good on my effort on Monday to share with you that information, but I did it in a very cursory way at that point, so I wanted to share it with you in a more specific way. And I hope you found that helpful. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back with your phone calls right after this.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right. Let's get this road show back on the road. I'm coming to your phone calls in a moment. First, though, Cyrus, I noticed that you posted 29 minutes ago on Twitter, Patrick's back.
Uh-huh.
I like the outfit, too.
Yeah, pretty, that pretty looks clever. Good.
Well, you might want to take a look at my response to that.
Great. Someone else put, since it's a photo of you like looking at the camera, mm-hmm. someone else put, that's Patrick's front. And I stared at that comment, and I'm like, what? What? Oh, I mean, it literally took me a couple of beats to get it. But very, very clever.
It's like fruit flies. No, it's not. Time flies like the wind. Fruit flies like bananas.
There's Patrick's back.
See? You won't understand it unless you see it.
All right. I get it.
Then you'll see it. All right.
Pretty funny.
To the phones. And yes, by the way, two things. We're going to be getting to the tarot card issue a little bit later in the program today. And even before that, I'm going to share with you I don't like the word epic because it's so overused. Epic this, epic that. Oh, it was so epic. This was epic. But I think in this particular situation, the word epic might be appropriate. I'll leave that for you to judge. But a few years ago, I did a live debate in front of like 1,500 people with none other than Father Mike Schmitz. You know him, you love him. And we did a debate. You know, I guess you might say it was sort of a mock debate, but it was a debate on same-sex marriage. And he took the position defending the church's teaching, the truth. I was assigned the position of promoting and defending in favor of same-sex marriage, which I do not believe in, of course. But in the time that I had available to me, I made an honest, sincere effort to get as much of the arguments in favor of same-sex marriage that are out there in this debate. And you're going to hear a chunk of that debate coming up. So if you've ever wondered, you know, how do you respond to people who say goofy things like love wins, or they have the equal sign, you know, on social media and all the clever, empty things that they say, you know, how do you respond to those things? Well, you're about to hear it. So please don't tune away at the top of the hour, because that's coming up right after that. Let's go to the phones. Let's start off with Joanne in Branchville, New Jersey. Hi, Joanne.
I just wanted to thank you. I had called back in late November to bring a project to a problem that I was having after visiting my son. I didn't like the way he disciplined his two-year-old, and you gave me beautiful advice. And let me tell you, that advice worked.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear it. Could you repeat that? I didn't hear what you said. It sounded like you said he disciplined a Tootsie Roll, but I'm sure that's not what you meant. I couldn't hear what you said.
That's too funny, but no, how he was disciplining his two-year-old. It made me very uncomfortable, the way he spoke. And you suggested that I speak to him and put himself in that role. And me, you know, years ago, disciplining him and maybe somebody making a comment about what I did. And it worked, you know, and again, to disciplining them age appropriately. And again, if they, sometimes they don't listen because they're not ready for the lesson, but it helped. And of course, praying to St. Joseph, who's the role model of fathers. But I wanted to thank you for that because I was very happy to hear that he's doing better.
Oh, you're so kind. I mean, first of all, I'm delighted to hear that our conversation paid some dividends. That's wonderful. But you are so kind to take a moment out of your busy day to let me know about that. That's very thoughtful of you.
Well, you're a good father. I know you have many children. And again, sometimes just sharing things makes a difference in all our lives. So again, thank you for your wonderful words.
Thank you. Brightened my day. Well, and you as well. You just brightened my day. Thank you for that. Let's see. Let's move from one sunshine to another sunshine. Let's go to Omar in Turlock, California. Hi, Omar.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so my question is for my wife. Her sister has asked her to be a witness at her civil marriage. Now, her sister was baptized Catholic, received all her sacraments, but has never practiced the faith. Now, she's divorced. The man she's going to marry is also divorced. And so we just want to know, would it be okay for my wife to be a witness at their civil marriage?
No, it wouldn't, because it's going to be an invalid marriage. And she's committing a serious sin. And to be a witness means that you're, in essence, you're testifying publicly by your presence there, and especially in the capacity as a witness, that everything's on the up and up, that you're there to say, yep, everything's on the up and up, and I'm here to testify to that. And of course it's not. So it actually would involve you not only in the sin of scandal, or your wife rather, but it would also be a form of perjury in a way. It's not formal perjury because you're not putting your hand on the Holy Bible and raising your other hand and swearing to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But it's sort of like the next step down from that. So it's a kind of public perjury. So for those two reasons alone, as painful as I'm sure it will be, I would not go.
Yeah. Okay. So this is, she was not married through the Catholic Church, but this is just because of the fact that she's baptized Catholic. Would that be the reason?
Yeah. In under the church's law, there's what's known as the requirement of canonical form. Canonical form is just a phrase that canon lawyers use to say, did you get married the right way? So the form that canon law requires for a Catholic, so we're talking about a baptized Catholic who's received the sacraments and practiced the faith for at least some period of time, even if he or she no longer practices the faith. Now, there is an interesting exception that's made in canon law for those who have, in some formal way, renounced the Catholic faith. But that's very atypical. Very rarely does that ever happen. So I'm sure it's not the case in this instance. But all other things being equal, baptized Catholics who have received their sacraments of initiation are bound by what's called a canonical form, which means that you must be married in a church, and that's a Catholic church, by the way. It could be a chapel, could be at the Catholic you know, maybe there's an order of religious sisters and they're making their convent chapel available to you. There are, you know, certain permissions that might need to be given, but under normal circumstances, it would be a Catholic church, and it would be witnessed by, in an official way, or officiated by, a Catholic priest or deacon or bishop. And if the couple decides for any reason to not do that outside of some grave necessity, like living in a place where there's no priest, and canon law says that if you want to get married, you have a right to get married, and you can get married, but you have to do it according to the church's canonical form. However, under certain extreme circumstances, let's say that for at least a month or more, that no priest can visit your area to officiate at the wedding, under extreme circumstances, a couple can get married, but invalidly so, but this is not one of those situations. And the bishop, I presume, has not given a dispensation. So outside of those extreme and unusual circumstances, if a baptized Catholic gets married, quote unquote, in any way that is other than the church's canonical form, it's ipso facto an invalid marriage. And, okay. And I think a lot of Catholics are unaware of that. But mm-hmm. even, oddly enough, even for those who are aware of it, many of them, they don't care. It's like, eh, whatever.
Yeah, so, that is true.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. My daughter has one quick question for you, Patrick. She wants to know where guardian angels go after you pass away.
Well, they're in heaven with you. So for those who go to heaven, they are our friends in heaven. Now, for those who go to hell, that's the end of that relationship. So the damned in hell don't see their guardian angels anymore. But the guardian angel is perfectly happy, whether the person in his care goes to heaven or hell. Ultimately, that's God's justice and mercy that plays out, and the angels, the good angels, are happy with that, however it turns out. But for the blessed in heaven, their guardian angels are there with them.
Okay,
in fact,
awesome.
And I don't know if this is from St. Thomas himself. I'd have to go back and double check on his treatise on the angels, but it may be from him. But he or somebody else commenting on this took up the question of, will our guardian angels have any duties toward us as they do in this life? Will they have any duties toward us in the life to come? And the response is that yes, and what they will have by way of duty is in heaven instructing us and revealing things to us, teaching us things in eternity. So apparently, unlike the angels who know everything that they can know all at once, they don't reason their way towards certain information the way we do. They're given to know everything all at once that they can know. Human beings are always learning. And so this theological opinion is that because we'll still be learning in heaven, or that we will still be learning in heaven, that those guardian angels will have a role in that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
Good talking to you. Yeah, thank you too. I appreciate it very much. Let's go to Brian in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Patrick. My daughter and I listen to you every day on her way to school.
Thank you.
We have a question for you, and we would like to know, why do the Jews still reject Jesus as the Messiah, and what type of Messiah are they expecting or waiting for now?
Well, I mean, the Jews, of course, would answer in their own terms what kind of Messiah they're expecting. Why do those who not accept him not accept him? I think the answers vary, but a few that I'm aware of would be, number one, they have never been properly evangelized. So many Jews who are, by and large, resistant to evangelization, nonetheless, maybe have never heard the gospel. No one's ever really properly taught it to them. So we can lay that at our own feet by way of blame. So to the extent that the Jews have not been adequately evangelized, that's our fault, not theirs. Another reason, in the case of those who maybe do know the story of Jesus and maybe have been evangelized, is because they have a different idea of a Messiah. And they don't accept the idea that God would become one of us. So the idea of the incarnation for many of them is very repellent. It's true, but for them, it seems very repellent, this idea that God would become one of us to save us. It was shocking and earth-shattering to the Jews of the time of Jesus when they discovered this truth. And many of them then rejected Jesus. Many of them accepted him. But it's the same drama played out 2,000 years later. I would refer you to a couple of books, Brian. I think you and your daughter, if this is a topic you're both, you know, contemplating, would be very interested in. The first book is called Salvation is from the Jews, and the second book is called Honey from the Rock. And both are written by, I want to get his first name correct, Roy Schoeman, S-C-H-O-E-M-A-N. And he's a convert from Judaism. And he's, of course, now a Catholic. And as a Catholic, he wrote these two books. One is a collection of conversion testimonies. That's called Honey from the Rock. And the other book, Salvation is from the Jews, is his treatise on why Jews should accept Jesus and become Catholic. So if you want it from somebody who himself was Jewish and certainly made that trip himself, either or both of those books I think would be very helpful. Hey, Brian, thank you again for listening to the program every morning on the way to school. I sure appreciate that. When we return, you're going to hear part of a debate that I did with Father Mike Schmitz on same-sex marriage. Please stay right there.